The Triathlon Show 298. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Dr. José Ramón Lillo. Dr. Lillo is a PhD and a researcher at the University of Alicante, and in this interview, we discuss his study where he has investigated whether the functional threshold power, or FTP, as measured by taking 95% of your average 20-minute power from a 20-minute all-out time trial, how that compares to actual maximum lactate steady state as measured in a lab, and also other physiological markers like the ventilatory thresholds measured in a gas exchange test. So that's all really interesting, and we'll get some practical recommendations regarding testing both in the field and in the lab from this episode. But before that, big thanks to our sponsors. First, we have Roka, that are the world-leading manufacturers of exceptional quality triathlon wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, performance sunglasses, as well as prescription eyeglasses and sunglasses. Roka was born as a project to create the world's fastest wetsuit, and today Roka has a large range of wetsuits, including the super fast Maverick X2 wetsuit with plenty of innovations, including the ArmSub technology, which is patented, but also the core exoskeleton that helps with power transfer from the hip to the upper body to create the most efficient swim stroke possible. But Roka is not just about the flagship models and the high-end wetsuits, but they have something for everybody, including entry-level wetsuits that still have their remarkable ArmSub technology that help you get maximum mobility in your wetsuit, especially when combined with a Roka trisuit, that where all of Roka's trisuits also have this ArmSub technology. If you're somebody that struggles with flotation, for example, and you tend to be a really heavy leg sinker, so to say, then the Max Buoyancy wetsuit from Roka could be the choice for you. It has even more buoyancy than the flagship Maverick X2 wetsuit, even though the price is very much in the mid-range of wetsuits, and it is in all other aspects as well a fantastic wetsuit that I use for most of my training, to be honest, and then I use the Maverick X2 mostly for racing. You can get 20% off your entire Roka order on roka.com/TTS. And thank you to Zen8 that you can find on zen8swimtrainer.com. The Zen8 Swim Trainer is an inflatable swim bench that you can use to complement your pool swim training and your open water swim training, either if you are time crunched and just need a little bit of additional swim stimulus frequency. Also, if you have specific needs to develop, for example, technique, working on a high elbow catch or core stability, the Zen8 Swim Trainer is great for those. And also for working on pure power and stamina, you can get quite a lot of work done in a fairly short time on dry land because the resistance is quite heavy when using stretch cords. But the difference with normal stretch cords, where you're just standing and maybe leaning forward, is that on the Zen8 Swim Trainer, you will actually do it specifically in the face down position of actual freestyle and or front crawl swimming. So it is much more specific as a movement than what you would be doing traditionally with just having the stretch cords hanging and you standing and pulling on them. Currently, Zen8 are running a summer sale, and this lasts until mid-August, so by the time this episode is out, it will probably only be maybe a week or so to go, so I really encourage you to check it out as soon as you possibly can after hearing this, because with the summer sale, you can get an additional discount on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS, taking your total discount to more than 40% when you purchase the swim trainer. So there really has never been a better time to get the Zen8 swim trainer done than now. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with José Ramón Lillo. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, José. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. How'd you do?
I'm doing good, thanks. Can you start by telling us where you're located and give us an introduction of yourself, what you're working with, what's your background in endurance sports, and so on?
Yeah. So actually, I'm living in Spain, in the East Coast, Alicante, I don't know. I don't know how to introduce myself. I mean, I just consider myself as a sports fan, you know, who enjoys practicing sports all my life. I'm doing something first, like most of us, by you know, in team sports, and for a lot of years, doing bike or riding or triathlons. I have a lot of experience and in all distances in triathlons and race. I mean, running or riding or cycling. But then I realized that I need to, you know, to make something else. And I prepare myself. I enroll in coaching courses and, you know, in a PhD at the university. And I, you know, my vision of the sport changed. So, but I'm still the same person. I mean, a fan, just someone who loves sports, especially endurance sports.
Tell us about what type of research have you been doing at the university?
Yeah, my PhD was focused on specifically on cyclists, endurance. First, we validate different tools. We validated an ergometer, the cyclist hammer, and then powered up pedals, because we needed some tools, reliable tools, to our next step, you know. And then we tried to focus on analyzing time to exhaustion, you know, different time trials, like 20 minutes time trials or FTP, fractional threshold power, and its relationship with time to exhaustion in cyclists specifically.
And time to exhaustion, is that what you were saying?
Yes, time to exhaustion, time limit, you know.
Yep.
And then something related to strength and, you know, some kind, but all related to endurance cyclists, specifically endurance cyclists.
Yeah. One study that I found, which led me to contact you, is where you investigated FTP and conventionally used FTP testing protocol and how it compares to, for example, the maximum lactate steady state. Yeah. And you did a lot of things in that study. So, but before we go into discussing exactly what you did and what you found, let's first discuss, for those listeners that may not be aware, talk about how is functional threshold power FTP conventionally tested in, as per Coggan and Allen, who were the inventors of the test.
Yeah. But traditionally, after the appearance of power meters in the market, probably around the 2000. These authors proposed to make some test easy to, you know, to perform, and they performed to make a test of 20 minutes in the field, specifically for cyclists. But since some years until now, even some runners adapted this test, because probably, as like most of you know, there are power meter for running. But the original proposal was a 20-minute time trial in the field, because these authors consider that at a specific intensity, that later we consider that probably they refer to the maximum lactate steady state. They consider that this intensity could allow cyclists to pedal for around 60 minutes until exhaustion. And then they decided that 60 minutes, a time trial of 60 minutes, is very demanding, especially if you need to, you know, do it regularly. So they decided to shorten this time trial to a 20-minute time trial with a specific coefficient to adapt. They proposed it, applying a 90% of the original and the average of the power output achieved in these 20 minutes.
95%.
95%, right. Sorry, 95%. Yep. They proposed that 95% in terms of power output and 98% in terms of heart rate. You know, that's the original proposal.
Yep, and one thing as well that we will discuss more is the warm up protocol. They had a specific warm up protocol. So can you briefly discuss that that protocol as well?
Yes. Yeah, these authors proposed a quite demanding warming up, including about 30 minutes of easy riding, then very demanding protocols. Again, 5 minutes easy, and then a 5 minute time trial, which is a really quite tough time trial just warming up. And then after 40, 45 minutes, finally we're ready to start the main time trial, the 20 minutes. So we considered that it was quite demanding because some cyclists started the main test very, very tired. So we decided that perhaps could be interesting to check an easier warming up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so to summarize, for the listeners, you would, in that long warm-up, you would have a five-minute all-out time trial even before you get started with your the actual 20-minute time trial, and then taking 95% of your average power for the 20-minute time trial would be that functional threshold power, which would kind of estimate your maximum lactate steady state. And let's get on to that then. What is maximum lactate steady state, or I should say, how is it measured? We have talked about maximum lactate steady state a lot on this podcast, so we don't need to go into that too much, but how do you actually measure it?
Yeah, so maximum lactate steady state is an intensity, the last intensity when metabolic situation of subjects, in this case cyclists, could be considered stable. We knew that it's not totally stable, but in terms of lactate production, the cyclic metabolists control this production, so they start and finish the trial, in this case, at a stable situation. The problem is that to determine this specific intensity, which is probably the most important in terms of long duration endurance, the problem is that we need several tests divided in tests of 30 minutes and intersected by rests of at least 48 hours. So it's a very demanding test, 30-minute test, and you need to rest 48 hours. And you need to between two and three tests at least to accurately determine this intensity. So that's why this author suggested that probably there was some easy time trial to estimate this intensity, you know.
Yep. Yep. So you would go into a lab several times and do a 30-minute effort where your lactate would be measured, and then once you find the correct power where you're at the time trial where your lactate is more or less stable, there is a specific definition for that. That's where you have your power at maximum lactate steady state, essentially.
Yeah. In fact, each of these 30-minute tests, we control lactate during specifically at minute 10 and minute 30. And we check if there are more than 1 millimole per liter of difference. If subjects are in this range, we consider that they are stable. If we test the lactate and we realize that the concentrations is higher, we decided, literature decide that they are in an unstable situation. So you have to adjust the load to control, you know, this concentration. So it's quite difficult. It's quite difficult and it's quite demanding for cyclists.
Yep. So your study then, can you describe what were your objectives? What were the things you're trying to find out in your study, and how did you do it? What methods did you use?
Yeah. We knew that we consider maximum lactate steady state as a gold standard. But we knew how difficult testing this specific intensity was. So we wondered at the beginning if FTP really represents the intensity of MLSS, you know? So we wondered, we tried to confirm the reliability of the 20-minute time trial. Despite the fact that we knew, because there was at that time at least one research that confirmed that it's really reliable. I mean, you get if you do the 20-minute time trial in two different days, the result in the same situation, the results are very similar. So we knew that it was reliable, but we tried to confirm that this point. We didn't know, because nobody at that time had confirmed this point. We didn't know where the result of the 20-minute time trial, where was it located compared with the main physiological events of the aerobic way. I mean, ventilatory threshold 1, ventilatory threshold 2, maximal aerobic power, maximal lactate, steady state. At that time, nobody had confirmed these relationships. So this was our second aim. And, okay, let's see that we can consider that there are a relationship. I mean, but how we are able of detecting the maximal lactate steady state with just one time trial, 20 minutes, in an easy way. I mean, with an equation, with just
Just a percentage of a coefficient.
Yeah. We try to look some easy way for practitioner, for coaches, or for researcher to determine this intensity. No?
Yeah. So how you did it? You had subjects do both maximum lactate steady state tests and the 20-minute time trial, and also you did a graded exercise test with ventilatory threshold measurements and maximum aerobic power measurements, and And then you compared these different the data and so found the correlations and the coefficients, how they relate to each other. How many cyclists did you have in the study, and what was their training status?
We started the study with 11 cyclists, trialists and cyclists, with a minimum of 55 milliliters kilo a minute of VO2 max. In the average, they were about 60 milliliters kilo a minute of VO2 max. They came into the lab for 7-8 visits, each one. We control a lot of variables. I mean, we control in hydration, rest. Of course, not that they were free of any kind of drugs or, you know, coffee or such a different exciting substances. Temperature of the lab, you know, wind by using a fan. You know, in the lab, you can control all the things, and you need to do it if you want to make reproducible, reliable results. You know.
Yep, and then if we go into the results, then so well, you mentioned already that you wanted to assess the reliability of the 20-minute time trial. So how similar results you get on two separate days in when you control for all those variables. So what did you find there? Is it reliable?
Yeah. As we thought, 20-minute time trial, it's a very reliable test. I mean, if you control the same variables, if you control cyclist recovery or, you know, ingestion or hydration, so you will get a very similar result, which is very important when you use a time trial to control the performance. I mean, they improve or the loss of performance. So we can confirm that this is a very reliable test.
Yeah. Just to clarify what you were saying there for the listeners is that if you have a test which is not reliable, you have a margin of error that is quite big, then you can't really measure improvement, because if there's a chance that your result will be, let's say, 7 or 8% lower or higher on any given day, then if you improve by 7 or 8%, you don't necessarily know that, because it could also be within the error margin of the test. So you need something which has low margins of error, so that you can actually monitor your improvements.
I mean, the results could be just a matter of luck. You know, you could consider that there are an improvement, but in fact there is no improvement at all. It's just luck, because that's the point. It's important to know that your test is reproducible, it's reliable, in order to be sure that what you are proposing to the cyclist in this case makes him or her to improve.
Yeah. And then this one will be really interesting, I think, for a lot of listeners. Where does the 20-minute time trial or the FTP protocol, so 95% of the 20-minute average power, where does that sit compared to the MLSS?
You mean where tests were performed?
Yeah, how it relates? How do they relate? How does the 20-minute test relate to the MLSS?
In terms of statistical, we must say that it's very. There are a high correlation. It means that if you your MLSS improve, probably your 20-minute time trial power output improve. But the point is, how far are these specific results? I mean, are they comparables? I mean, you can use one or another. So it's the point. So in this case, despite the fact that the original author suggested a reduction of 5%, I mean, a coefficient of 0.95 to correct and to compare, we detected that, in fact, it was overestimating the real maximal lactate steady state. So we considered that, and we've proved that it would be better to apply a correction factor of 0.91. Even there are different, nowadays there are at least two papers who suggest applying a more conservative, I mean, about 0.90 of correction factor to be sure that you don't overcome the maximum lactate steady state intensity.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't have your paper in front of me here now, but you had a figure that showed the results of all the participants, and so you can see, well, what is the variability? Is there somebody who is at 100% or somebody is at 80%? But that wasn't the case. It really seemed that most people were within that sort of 91 plus minus 2% or so. I think there was one person maybe that was at 95%, but that was the highest of all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it really seemed quite consistent there, closely, quite tightly bound around that 91%.
Yeah. You mean, in a statistical terms, you could say that with confidence interval of 90%, I mean, we are pretty sure that 90% of the subjects might be between 0.9 and 0.93, you know?
Yep.
So, but there are always some specific subjects who are out of these normal features. In our paper, we realized that there was one subject which relationship was 0.88, and the other, which relationship was 0.95. This is very important because it's something that normally we miss. I mean, we forget. We know that everyone reacts in a different way. Every people has his own profile. But then when you read a paper, you know, seems that it's everything easier than in fact it is. No, I mean, it's important to individualize because every human being and every, animal reacts in a different way and in front of an stimulus, you know?
Yeah. And from a training and coaching perspective, I would say that, okay, if you're the individual that is really your MLSS is 95% or 20-minute power, but you choose to take because you don't know your individual correlation because you haven't done an MLS test, 91% or 92%, that's probably going to be fine for training anyway. But maybe if you're that person that is at really your MLSS is only 88% of your 20-minute power, but you use a threshold that is a bit higher, use a coefficient that is higher, 91 or 92%, then that's still potentially going to be not ideal for you to think that your threshold is higher than you are. I, as a coach, at least personally, always think that it's better to underestimate than to overestimate. But I think the example there that you gave, it is just to illustrate that you can have these formulas and even from studies like yours, from research, but you still need to remember that there's an individual behind everything and you can go, there's more than you can do than just apply the latest and most validated formula. You really need to look into the individual at the end of the day.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's better to underestimate than overestimate, especially in this intensity. I mean, because the main factor here is this limit concentration of lactate. So if you overestimate just for 8, 10 watts, it will produce that instead of pedaling for 30 minutes, or when you test the exhaustion at that specific intensity, we got different subjects who achieve to pedal for nearly 90 minutes at this specific intensity, maximal lactate steady state. But just 8, 10 watts over here, they couldn't pedal for 30 minutes. Some of them had to stop. So if you have some doubt, I suggest to underestimate no matter 10, 15 watts, because the stimulus is quite similar, but you don't produce this acidosis which could impair the real performance. Your cyclists perform your workout. So if you overestimate, probably you will have problem to, or he has, she will have problem to finish the workout. You know, so yes, I suggest be conservative and considering an 88 or a 90% of coefficient, specifically if you try to stimulate the maximum lactate steady state.
Yeah. One thing that we should discuss here is the warm-up. So in the study, you had a shorter warm-up than the original protocol and less intense warm-up. You didn't have that five-minute all-out time trial. So, of course, there was one reason that you had that, I think, is to just validate this easier test protocol, which is easier to do, less stressful on the body to do. But I guess the argument is that also that it's not exactly the same as the original protocol. So maybe it was right for the original protocol to be 95% because people were already very tired from the five-minute all-out time trial. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, could be. There are people who need, in order to feel confident, need a longer warming up. It's true. In this case, of course, we needed to compare both warming ups. I mean, the warming up use it for determine the maximum lactate steady state, and the warming up use it to do the time trial, the 20-minute time trial. So if you want to compare, you'd have to, you know, share the same warming up. Besides, we considered that probably, a weak point in the original warm-up is that not everyone starts the 20-minute time trial in the same recovery level, depending on how hard the warm-up has been. No, so probably in this way, we are sure we are not worried about the VO2 max level or the experience of the cyclist or the kind of muscle fibers the cyclist that we are testing could have. We consider that in this way, we were pretty sure that all started in recovery status, a proper recovery status. But furthermore, there are an interesting paper of Spanish researcher called Barranco Gil and Coles, collaborators. They tested the same test. I think it was published last year. They tested the same test, a 20-minute time trial, but comparing to three different warming ups. The first one was the traditional. The second one were 10 minutes, 10 minutes at 60% of the maximal aerobic power. And the third option was starting the time trial without warming up. And surprisingly, the result proved that results in the power output, the mean power output of the 20-minute time trial, were quite similar.
So, interesting.
According to these authors, there's no relationship between the warming up and the result of the test. I don't know. Interesting. It could be confirmed. Yep. Our hypothesis. I don't know.
Yep, that is very, very interesting to hear, and I'll try to look up that paper and put that in the show notes. I will also put your links to your papers in the show notes for the episode. But yeah, if that is the case, if the different warm-ups really produce a very similar power, then of course it makes more sense to do a shorter warm-up and easier warm-up, or in most cases it does anyway, because you don't have to spend as much time on it, and you potentially don't have to dig yourself as deep of a hole by doing an additional time trial there. A 5-minute time trial really can be quite taxing. So I think that's really interesting information.
Yeah, there are an additional point is that sometimes this 5-minute time trial, this all out, I mean, it's a very demanding test that a lot of coaches use as a predictor, as a way of establish the maximal aerobic power intensity. So in this way, using this warming up, you could get two different events. I mean, the event that you are looking for, I mean, the maximal lactate steady state and the maximal aerobic power intensity. But in fact, and as have been proved in cycling, the time to exhaustion at MAP, at maximal aerobic power, barely overcome the 4 minutes. And in some cyclists, I mean, it's more between 3 and 4 minutes. So 5 minutes is not really useful. So yep. It produces a really extreme fatigue previous to the main test, which is that is 20 minutes. And it doesn't give you this additional information. You know, I think it's easier to use at least not so tough warm-up, you know. If your cyclist feels more confident, so, okay, you can use a longer warming up. But in terms of aerobic development, not in terms of, you know, very demanding efforts.
Yeah, I would agree with that, definitely. And also there's an argument that there are some cases where MAP, maximal aerobic power, knowing that could be useful. But I would argue, and this is just my personal opinion, that it is much less useful for training prescription than knowing your maximum lactate steady state, because even when doing high intensity interval training, you would often set a workout and the cyclist goes and does the workout at their best possible effort. Let's say they're doing 15 times 1 minute, 1 minute on, 1 minute off, and then they just do the best they can for 15 times 1 minute on, 1 minute off. You don't have to say that this is at MAP or 95% of MAP or anything like that. And my personal preference, and I want to emphasize that this is just my personal opinion, but MAP has quite limited usefulness in practical application in training, even though it's, of course, very, very useful for being able to standardize things and intensities in research settings. So that's where it's super useful.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, actually, this kind of intensities are so linked with recovery situation. Recovery status. I mean, we can estimate the maximum lactate steady state today, right now. But if you go out here in Spain with 10 degrees over, you know, the temperature where you, when you estimated that maximum lactate steady state, the threshold, the intensity has changed and is well known. I mean, or if you go to a lab and you do a full test to know your thresholds, then if you are tired because yesterday trained very hard, or you don't slept well, or they're really cold today, or they're really warm. This threshold have changed. So probably, yes, true, this kind of test are really useful to test in a specific point how your performance improve or not, more than using like fixes, static points.
And definitely, yeah, I agree. We've both been up watching the Olympic triathlon late last night and just slept 4 or 5 hours. So today, if either one of us is going out and doing a threshold workout, our threshold is probably, it probably makes sense to keep the power down a bit compared to what we would normally do, I would say.
Yes, they were affected, all of them. Actually, the difference is how they bear these temperatures. I mean, actually, who adapted and who less performance, I don't know how to say, no, but actually the point is
minimal performance decrease.
Yes, that's the point
for the hit. One other question that I have is, so you also measured the second and the first ventilatory threshold in these cyclists and compared that, and you found that the second ventilatory threshold was actually higher, I think, than the 20-minute average power, not just the 95% or the 91%, but higher than even the 20-minute power, or do I misremember that? But it was quite high. Can you discuss a bit around the second ventilatory threshold and how that relates to the 20-minute time trial?
Actually, we knew that the second threshold, it's located over this time trial. I mean, 20-minute time trial result. Actually, the time trial, the 20-minute time trial result, the power output, mean power output, it's located between maximum lactated state and BT2, and it is well known. And there are a huge difference. I mean, we are talking a 40-50 watts of difference between both. It is well known. Besides, we tested in a different paper, we tested the time to exhaustion at this both intensity. I mean, MLSS and VT2. And results were extremely different. I mean, subjects at maximum lactate steady state were able to perform between 60 and 90 minutes until exhaustion. But on the contrary, at VT2, on average, they only perform for 11 minutes. Why? Because the limit factors are different. I mean, when you talk about VT2 or, riding a VT2, the limiting factor is the acidosis. I mean, the quantity of acid lactate that it's in your blood and how your body deal with this situation. On the contrary, maximal lactate state, the limiting factor is the disponibility of glycogen. I mean, you have under control the lactic acid, so you will be cycling, pedaling while your body has glycogen in the muscles. They are so different that they cannot be compared. Despite that, probably there are a lot of researchers who nowadays big arguments about this. But for us, it's a very clear difference.
Yeah, and I want to draw the attention to this because, and I might have probably said this myself in some podcast, but it's often used interchangeably. Like we say that, oh, MLSS is roughly the same as VT2 and it's roughly the same as LT2. They're all roughly the same. They're not exactly the same, but they're roughly the same. But actually, VT2, as we saw, can be very, very much higher. And it's something that I get emails about every once in a while from somebody who has done a lab test, a graded XMS test, and they say that, well, this VT2, it doesn't seem to make sense. I can't ride that hard for very long, or it's way higher than my perceived threshold. And it is like that because, as you say, the limiting factors are different. You might, in a ventilatory perspective, you are fine. You're at or below your, or you're at your threshold. You're not above your threshold, but from a metabolic substrate use perspective, you are using so much anaerobic energy and producing so much acidosis that that you're limited in that way. So I think that was interesting to see in your study and to see the comparison that actually VT2 can be at a really, really high power. But also, it makes you think that, is there really much practical use for VT2? Again, in research, yes, maybe there is use to standardize things and so on. But in practice, in training, if you go to a lab and do a test and you get your VT2, would you use it for anything?
Yes. I think all these events, all these intensities are important, but depending on the specialty. I mean, if you are a runner and you run the mile, probably there's no point to know exactly where the maximum lactate steady state is, because in your competition, you won't be near that intensity. You really need to know where your maximal aerobic power is. Yeah. That is the intensity you are going to, you must focus. In the case of, for example, of mountain bikers, especially in rally, in the Olympic distance, where the races are very demanding, but they don't pedal for 60 minutes at the same intensity. I mean, they have different accelerations, different short efforts of 3, 4, 5, 6 minutes. So it's important to know where the VT2 is, even more important than the maximal lactate steady state. You know, that's what I mean. I mean, it's important or not, depending on your specialty.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense to me. The final question that I have is that, what other tests would you, or what testing do you recommend for coaches and athletes to use? And you can recommend several if you think that it makes sense to do many tests. What field tests do you think would be good to do? What lab tests, if any, do you think would be good to do? What's your take? If you're an athlete or you're a coach, what do you recommend to others to do?
Look, I mean, it's quite useful nowadays in cycling, professional cycling. Make some, ventilation tests. I mean, with a gas, you know, with a mask and so on, to know the specific characteristic of the cyclist. But then during the year, sometimes some cyclists perform a some time trial like the 20 minutes because it's easy to do. You can do it in a workout as a part of the workout, and you can control, you know, how your working out is or your program is going, you know.
Yep.
But nowadays, you know that some in this case in cyclists, for example, in road cyclists, especially in elite, in professionals, they use their profile because they compete a lot and they make really high efforts nearly every week. So they don't need to make a test. I mean, there's not just one test. There are different tests. These tests must be adapted to your you know, speciality, to your really your demands in competition demands, you know. So I don't suggest a test, just a test. I think it's a matter of, you know, decide what it's the one that better fits with the specific speciality, and be constant. You know, I mean, repeat the same test in order to be to be able to compare.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think it's very individual, and it might also have to be do not just with a specific discipline or specialty, but also the type of athlete. If you think that the athlete, and this is speaking from a coach's perspective, but sometimes I might have a feeling that that an athlete might be, let's say, we want to have some more metabolic data, and then a lactate test would be a good thing to do. And in other cases, it might be more interesting to figure out, well, are we, how far from the limit is this athlete in terms of their current VO2 max versus what we are doing? And then a gas exchange test might be useful. And in other cases, we're really mostly interested in performance readiness for an event, and then some field test might be the best thing to do. So yeah, there are very different many different scenarios and contexts. And I think the most important thing is that when you do a test, you should know why you're doing it and what actionable information you're getting out of it. You should already have a hypothesis for how you can use the information from the test to better inform your training.
Yeah, that's the point. I mean, for example, we have been talking about the triathlon developed yesterday evening. You know?
Yeah.
Imagine in that situation, it could be very interesting to know how your cyclist or your triathlete perform in a specific temperature or humidity. To control, you know, the real performance. I mean, you could be the best cyclist of the world, but if you are not really adapted, or you make an effort that you are not able to support to bear with, you know, in the competition, then you probably could be, you know, overcome your limits. So that's the point. I mean, you need to focus. You need to be clear what you want, what you need to know, what you want to test, and be consistent.
Yeah, and that's the Olympics yesterday is a great example. Just for the listeners, we're recording this when the men's race happened yesterday. The women's race hasn't happened yet as we're recording this, but Christian Blumenfeld took the gold medal. And I don't know, Jose, if you're aware, but I have interviewed the Norwegian coach, Arild Tveiten, a couple of times on the podcast. And the Norwegian triathletes, they test a lot, and they do a lot of very interesting specific testing. They have done a lot of testing in the heat and humidity, as you mentioned. They also do a lot of testing, for example, run testing after having done hard swimming and hard biking to simulate, well, what is your fatigue resistance like? So that specific, this specific Olympic gold medal from Christian Blumenfeld is a great example that testing can be useful when you do it right, when you know what you're doing and you apply the information correctly.
You're right. Interesting.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all the questions I had for you regarding the study. Let's just finish up with the rapid fire questions. So please answer these in just one sentence and per question. And the first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to endurance sports?
There's not just a book, but I would say two different, if possible. Yep. The first one is the Bible of physiology called Exercise Physiology of Sharon Plowman and Dennis Smith, which is obviously a really important publication. But I would like to recommend a second one, but I'm not sure that it's in English. It's called The Execution Speed as a Reference for the Programming Control and Evaluation of the Strength of an author called Gonzalo Badillo, a Spanish professor, who introduced 20 years ago this control of strength by velocity, by speed. You know, it's very interesting, easy to read, and I don't know.
That sounds very interesting. We do have Spanish listeners and Spanish speaking listeners, so I'll try to find that book and put it in the show notes as well. What's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
I think the main point here is always the same: consistency. I mean, in every aspect of life, train, work. You know, build over your building, be constant is the point. I mean,
yep, absolutely. And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
Of course, I have to say that Dr. García Pallarés, who was my thesis director, who is a really hard worker. Incredibly hard worker, but I will also mention Ricardo Mora, who is a professor in the University of Castilla-La Mancha, who is what I really consider a researcher. I mean, a brilliant, simple, honest worker, hard worker. You know, I mean, they are both really reference for all of us.
Brilliant. And finally, if listeners want to follow your work, what is the best place to do that? Is it Twitter or ResearchGate or anywhere else that people can follow you?
Yeah, they can see it, search in ResearchGate my paper, my publication, my thesis, I have a Twitter user, but I don't use it too much. So probably ResearchGate is the point.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll put that link in the show notes as well. Thank you so much, Jose. It was great to chat to you.
A pleasure. A pleasure to talk with you. Really a honor to talk with you in a really interesting podcast.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Leo. I think that the conclusion of this episode is really simple and practical. For me, it is that a lot of athletes use functional threshold power or FTP as an anchor point for their training zones or their power targets. And in many cases, that is a decent way to go about things. But the problem is often that the 95% of 20-minute power really does overestimate your actual maximum lactate steady state significantly. You're not at a steady state usually at that 95% of 20-minute power. So it's biased towards higher intensities when you use that as your anchor point. So instead of doing that, using a more conservative correction factor around 90%, as we discussed, will result in much more accurate training targets that actually represent what you think that you are training. That if you are training your threshold, you really are still on that threshold where you are training in a more or less steady state, semi-steady state at least. I have personally for many years used 92 or maybe 93% rather than 95% in those cases where I have used classic FTP testing with athletes that I coach. And if you have been using the scientific triathlon training plans, you've seen that we're using those coefficients as well in the 92 to 93% range. But no doubt going forward, I will take the information we have presented here today and start using 90% as a better estimate of MLSS. And just again, coming back to that principle, it's better to be a little bit conservative, even if you personally might be spot on with using 92 or 93%. 90% is not going to be a problem, but 95% could still be a problem. So I recommend, if you are a self-coached athlete, that you do that as well. That's a very warm recommendation from myself. Just keep in mind, you might have to change your perception of intensities and types of workouts a bit. If you're used to struggling to do 6 times 4 minutes at threshold, and that now that feels like a breeze, well, it is because that's what threshold should feel like, and maybe threshold training isn't as much about doing 6 times 4 minutes as it is about doing maybe some more total time at intensity in that particular example. That's it for my conclusion. I'll just mention, of course, that as usual, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with links to studies mentioned and also the book mentioned by Dr. Leo. And if you are looking for coaching services or training plans, do check out scientifictriathlon.com and what we have to offer there. If you are looking to take your training and performance to the next level, getting the help of professionals to help you do that is really the best thing you can do. So I hope that we can help you out and you consider us if you're in the market for coaching or training plans. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses, and get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. And thank you to Zenate, that you can find on zenateswimtrainer.com. Use the swim trainer to improve your technique, power, and stamina, and increase your swim stimulus frequency even when you can't go to the pool or open water. You can get more than 40% off your order until mid-August, so ending very soon, when you combine the current summer sale with the discount code that you can get on zenateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.